Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, March 11th. Pushing back against science cuts, just this weekend, reports have surfaced that another 1,000 federal workers at NOAA are expected to be cut. It's unclear how Hawaii will be affected, but the National Weather Service and National Marine Fisheries are bracing for the hatchet to fall. We hear from a former chief scientist for NOAA. We hear about Aloha State Daily, part of the changing media landscape here in the islands. And Honolulu Civil Beat has details from the lawsuit filed against Sean Diddy Combs. It's added Maui's police chief to the civil complaint, and the mayor has called for Chief Pelletier to be put on administrative leave. We talked to a scientist studying a crafty parasitic fly that's perfecting the art of speedy evolution. And we hear about a German film festival that's set for this Friday at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Stand Up for Science rallies took place across the continent and even overseas in Paris and Vienna on Friday. The protests are against the cuts by the Trump administration, which affect programs under the National Institutes of Health, NASA, and more. This morning, we heard from a former chief scientist for NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, which includes the National Weather Service and the National Marine Fisheries. Sylvia Earle is in town here in Honolulu to help the Polynesian Voyaging Society celebrate the 50th anniversary of the launching of the Hokulea canoe. We talked to her this morning and got a reaction to the CBS News weekend reporting about the possibility of cuts of another 1,000 workers at NOAA. The list for the reduction in force is said to be due later this week. Earle laments the tremendous loss to the public if science goes by the wayside.
It's just a terrible mistake to undercut an agency like NASA that serves the interests of everyone across the country and around the world. We take what NOAA provides very much for granted. It's like the air you breathe. You just expect the weather report to be there. You expect knowledge about the ocean, about the basic systems that safeguard the habitability of Earth to be there. But it doesn't just happen automatically. It happens because there are people out there observing and reporting on the nature of nature and giving that information, distilling it in ways that really provide the basis of being able to predict your future, whether it's the next day or the next month or far into the future. NOAA was intended to be something basically like a counterpart of NASA back in 1970 when it was first formed, referred to NOAA as the wet NASA, bringing the atmosphere and ocean together to really understand better than we ever had before the nature of this part of the universe, this planet Earth. NASA has been so really helpful in looking at the skies above and the universe beyond and working in partnership with NOAA to really understand what's going on that makes Earth habitable and to understand how we can live in a more predictable way, working with the information that is newly available in recent decades. To cut that is just absurd. It shows profound ignorance on the part of those who are conducting this shrinking of the government. There may be some justification for downsizing the federal government, but there's a smart way to go about it. You don't go on a diet reducing your weight by chopping off your head or losing an arm or leg. You do it strategically if you have to do it at all. And here we are witnessing a reduction of an agency on an almost arbitrary basis without understanding what the agency actually does.
Well, right? I think the concern is the speed at which these cuts are happening. Just years of research is dangling on the line because it's so broad brush and there's no, you know, orderly shutdown as one might imagine things should happen. I don't know what you're hearing from the trenches, you know, with your contacts through NOAA.
Well, it's not realistic to think you can simply replace more than 50 years of developing a structure that serves the interests of the country in a very solid way. It's hard to understand why the benefits that are derived from an agency measuring and reporting of the underpinnings of the natural phenomena that underpin the habitability of Earth. You know, we take it for granted that we will have predictions about storms, about the overall nature of the world we live in.
One big fear I know is that the Weather Service is going to be privatized, and this public information that is available to all will then be only available at a price.
Right.
And there are so many other concerns about the fisheries management and just exploration in the ocean. And we have still so much to learn about the ocean, good basic science. And from what I understand and what I'm reading, a half of NOAA's workers are scientists and engineers.
That's correct. It's a science-based organization that serves the interests in a way that, as I say, we've been complacent, taking it for granted. Like breathing, you just expect it will always be there. But this is one of the agencies, for sure. Mm-hmm. If privatized, will put at risk reliable, non-partisan. This should not be a political issue.
What do you think we should be doing?
Raise your voice. First, know the facts. When you get a weather report, download your app about what the weather's going to be. Where does that information come from? It originates by the scientists who work with NOAA and in partnership with science-based institutions globally. It's a network that is independent of anything but just basic factual observations, providing a trustworthy, reliable information, not viewed by wishful thinking, but just here are the facts. Here's the nature of nature. We're here to give you the best, most reliable insight into the nature of what's happening to the planet. And for you, whether you're a farmer or whoever you are, every citizen benefits from having that information to be able to understand where the nature of the world we live in, predictability about planning your future to the best of our ability by understanding the nature of nature, communicating it in a just a very straightforward, non-biased way. Just hear the facts.
What is the heartbreak for you? I mean, you are looking at a career, a lifetime of exploration and conservation, and to see what's happening to this agency now?
We should, as citizens who benefit from what NOAA provides to all of us, we should be forceful in insisting that it be protected and be kept independent from biases that would inevitably occur if privatized. It makes no sense. They're not trying to privatize NASA, although elements of it are. But you may not be aware of where information originates. It does not originate through some of the distribution centers that take advantage of NOAA's data.
Yeah, it's very troublesome, as we see, like I said, not only what's planned, but the speed at which it's happening. Unless it's blocked, then the damage is done, and it will just take, you know, years to get back up to where we're at now.
We should be thankful for those who, back in 1970, brought the atmospheric science community, the ocean community, together under one agency, and the benefits for being able to predict phenomena such as El Nino and the La Nina, to be able to understand, as we just could not before, by gathering data and making it publicly available in a form that we can actually use every day to gather insights that are valuable to all of us everywhere, and partnering with like agencies and institutions globally. It's a unique time in history when, as never before, we have knowledge that could not exist but for the efforts that have been invested. And to lose that would be a loss to everyone.
That was former NOAA chief scientist Sylvia Earle talking about the effects that further cuts to the agency could have on public access to essential information that the agency provides. Earle holds the record for the deepest walk on the ocean floor, and through her life's work as a marine scientist, is a National Geographic explorer. She is in Honolulu to help the Polynesian Voyaging Society celebrate the 50th anniversary of the voyaging canoe Hokulea. Thank you.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater, presenting five Iranian films, including Shada, Persepolis, and The Persian Version, on now. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Maui is dealing with quite a bombshell. Mayor Richard Bisson put Police Chief John Pelletier on leave after a civil lawsuit linked the chief and other prominent figures to Sean Diddy Combs and his ongoing sex scandal. Honolulu Civil Beat has details from the actual lawsuit. Here to talk about that is Politics Editor Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, this is quite a story that Aaron...
It really is. Yeah, Erin Nolan, our reporter over on Maui, and we'll get her on HBR one of these days. She's new to our staff, but she's covering Maui. And here, very early on, you used the word bombshell. It is a remarkable story with Mayor Bisson wanting Pelletier, the chief, to be on administrative leave. The mayor is concerned about allegations that Pelletier had some sort of role in this scheme of assaults, sexual assaults, physical assaults, involving Combs, who is also known as Puff Daddy. And I think Combs has been held in a Brooklyn jail, I think, since September now. And the charges, many of them, are that he was involved with sex trafficking. And now allegations surfacing that Pelletier is somehow involved.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. The chief came over here after several decades in Vegas, right, as the chief there.
Yeah, that's interesting because where this is all coming from is that one of the lawsuits was actually amended last week, and that's where Pelletier's name showed up. And it actually mentions Las Vegas. It mentions Northern California. This is something that was filed in district court there. And the suggestion is somehow that Pelletier was involved somehow abducting somebody, perhaps at gunpoint, somehow facilitating an assault involving Combs, and it is really remarkable. By the way, we have actually embedded the entire lawsuit on our website. So if you scroll to the bottom of Aaron's article, you will find it. It's interesting. Right up high, there's a trigger warning. It actually says highly graphic. It does actually go into some detail. It is indeed graphic, and there's some pictures as well. We should say Bisson has asked the Maui Police Commission to have an independent review of this. The mayor says, look, the allegations are unproven, but these are serious. He's worried about the integrity being compromised of the Maui Police Department. And as I said, he wants this independent investigation.
Yeah, I mean, that's understandable. And yeah, we understand that Maui PD, released a statement saying that the chief has no connections to those individuals in the lawsuit. But it just seems so out of left field.
Right. Two responses. One from Maui PD, which has had no comment, actually. This was as of late Monday, but there was a statement coming from Pelletier's aide who did say that, look, yeah, as you put it, there was no connection from the chief to anyone in this lawsuit. By the way, Pelletier was hired in 2021, right? So he's been here for the last 4 years. But Anna Pico, the assistant to the chief, is saying, we're confident that these claims are going to be proven false. But they are pretty remarkable. By the way, this is coming from a woman, Ashley Parham. She's the person who filed the complaint along with two unnamed plaintiffs. But yes, there are allegations of rape. There's, as I said, allegations of abduction from gunpoint. It really is quite remarkable to read.
Well, yeah, it is stunning. Because Pelletier was in Vegas. But he was also, they said, honored by the Rape Crisis Center, right, for his commitment to community safety.
Yeah, and, you know, if you talk to legal experts, I mean, these kind of suits get filed all the time. And just because it's been filed doesn't make it true, and that there has to be, you know, there's a legal process involved here. But they're also very sensational, and sure enough, this story is shot to the top of our stories at Civil Beat today, and the story is getting around elsewhere. I mean, when you bring in a rapper like Sean Combs with all these allegations, and now you throw in a Maui police chief, it's bound to attract a lot of clicks, at least clicks on our website.
Yeah, it is, you know, you can allege anything in a lawsuit, but now the question is, yeah, can they prove it and will it stick? But it certainly has eyebrows raised over here.
Yeah, and we'll keep you posted on this. I'm sure Aaron over there on Maui will continue to follow this story with any updates. We're all kind of eagerly trying to find out what exactly is involved here.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Chad.
You're welcome, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair about a bombshell development in a very high-profile case involving Sean Dilly Combs and Maui's police chief. You can check out the lawsuit at civilbeat.org. There is a new addition to the media landscape in Hawaii, and it's called Aloha State Daily. The new outfit is exclusively online and aims to cover a range of topics from politics and arts to sports and the economy. And there is a familiar face and voice leading the site. Akam Napier, who was the editor-in-chief of Pacific Business News for a decade, he stopped by our studios last week to tell us what he hopes this new outfit can add to local journalism.
You can find us at alohastatedaily.com. We're free to read. We're free to subscribe to our daily newsletter that comes in the morning. You get all our top headlines. And we are just aiming to be the new news for Hawaii. We have 5 reporters. We're at an office downtown on Alakea Street. Terrific view. We can see the state capitol, Iolani Palace, City Hall, all those places we need to keep an eye on, right?
You're at the CBB building.
Exactly. You know, we're covering government and politics, real estate, business, the economy, tourism, sports, food and dining, arts, culture, entertainment, just everything that people would be interested in, with more to come. We're going to continue to grow. Coming up soon is our second month anniversary.
Okay.
So we debuted on January 13th.
Tell us about how this all came about. I mean, we have been doing stories about the media landscape, the shrinking landscape, where newsrooms are cutting staff. And yet, in the last few months, we've just seen some new stories online.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's a time of change for sure in the media, and old outlets are adapting and new outlets are popping up. And so this is an opportunity that came my way, and I just found it irresistible, a chance to get in on the ground floor of something brand new. You know, my whole career here, a lot of folks at public radio may know me because I have been on the air for so long with you. I'm born and raised here, and I have felt so lucky to be able to stay home and do what I want to do for a living in my own hometown. I was at Honolulu Magazine for 19 years. I was with Pacific Business News for 10. You know, and both of those are legacy outfits with tremendous history behind them, and that's very cool and very exciting. This is my first time starting something, so that's a whole new kind of excitement.
And when I got wind of this, I was told, oh, there's another sister outfit called the Cowboy State Daily.
Right, Cowboy State Daily.
In Wyoming, right?
Yeah, that's true. So we're privately owned and locally operated, and you know, our investor has ties to Hawaii. He's a high net worth individual. You know, that's about all we say about that. This person would really rather people look at Aloha State Daily and pay attention to the news that we're doing and the work that the crew is doing. Yeah, it's fun to have a sister publication. If you look at them, you see a very, very local publication that reflects Wyoming. And with us, you're going to see a very, very local publication that reflects Hawaii.
Well, Honolulu Civil Beat did a little article mm-hmm. on your funder mm-hmm. talking about his red roots. And, mm-hmm. you know, they point out that they have a funder, Pierre Omidyar,
right.
who has blue roots, you
right,
know, but
right.
they say they have a firewall to make sure that mm-hmm. things are straight and narrow.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, that's the way to go. What our goal is on the reporting side is to tell people what happened and not how to feel about what happened, not what to think about what happened. You know, that's for the reader to decide. It takes some discipline to do that because everybody has their biases. You know, I do. I'm sure all the reporters do. Everyone in our industry has bias one way or another. And then as we grow, you know, we're starting to add some voices, community voices side, and we'll be adding columnists as well. This week, we debuted a new column from Lopaka and Tanya Kapanui. It's a ghost column because Hawaii history
yes.
and ghost stories, we love that sort of thing. You know, we'll be adding other regular columnists as well. And we're starting to bring in some viewpoints from around town. Those tend to be reprints of things that we think readers would be interested in. To start, we have Grassroot Institute and Tax Foundation of Hawaii. And I'm easily reachable, cam@alohastatedaily.com. Email me if you're involved with an organization that has a viewpoint on things and you'd like to get that out, because we would love to have a wide range of opinion on the opinion side. So the reporting is just what happened. Or what's coming up on the arts and entertainment and the food and dining side and the sports side. We're going to tell you about things you can go experience and enjoy. And on the opinion side, we want a wide range. And, you know, I may even be popping into that space once in a while myself. That would be fun.
It's interesting just because of media landscaping changing so much and so drastically that, you know, we were a 2-newspaper town, right? Daily newspaper, and then we were 1.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that, you know, when Sybil Beat first emerged on the scene, you know, mm-hmm. that was kind of a big shakeup, right? Online
right.
only.
Right.
And there are predictions that the newspapers are going to go away soon. And so I don't know if it's just, you know, outfits positioning themselves in what will be our future.
Right, right. Well, we're online only. There's no print edition. This is a first. I was joking around with you earlier. This is the first time I've done a media appearance, and I didn't have a copy of what we do that I brought with me, because it's on the internet, right? So people read us online. From the stats, I can tell that they're reading us through their phones primarily, even more than desktop. People are reading us through the email newsletter. So, yeah, you know, a lot of the legacy outfits, there is remaining momentum behind the revenue streams that they get from the advertising on their legacy product, whether it's a printed newspaper or a television broadcast, a radio broadcast. But those things come with some fairly steep expenses as well that you're chained to and can't exactly control. So the price of electricity for the broadcast folks, paper, printing, ink, distribution for the print media folks. So our business plan is to grow an audience and sell advertising and be self-sustaining and self-supporting and profitable in the long run. And I feel very optimistic about that.
Yeah, you know, learning last year that the Star Advertiser was not going to be doing home delivery in Waikiki, and that just was like mm-hmm. jarring to me, like, you're just mm-hmm. not going to deliver. That to me is just very fascinating
mm-hmm.
and, you know, thinking, wow, is this the beginning of the end?
Right. Well, it may be the beginning of the end for certain formats, but I think it's the beginning for new ways to do journalism and reach people where they are and where they're reading, where they're living, where they're hearing about things. You often hear people say, oh, I get my news from social media. Well, social media doesn't actually employ any reporters. What I think they often mean is that they saw a journalistic enterprise doing some reporting, and that headline was on social media, right? So we're on 4 major channels. You know, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, we're on X. So if someone sees our stories there, they might say, yeah, I get my news from social media. But really, and ideally, I hope that they're going to come and get it from us. You know, it's a big world out there. There's probably some other outlets people are reading.
Yeah, it is fascinating, though, how the technology has changed our habits. I know for me, I'm on my phone for more hours than I hate to admit.
Yeah.
But I know, I think my vision's changing. I don't know if that's just because I'm getting older or I'm focused on this tiny
sure.
screen.
Yeah.
Because I don't have, you know, a desktop
right.
at home.
You know, I guess what marks me as an old timer now is I read the website for Aloha State Daily. You know, I check the phone version to make sure it looks okay. But I read what we do on the desktop. And most of my media consumption that's online is still through a desktop.
Anything about the trends, though, nationwide, I guess, that strikes you at this point as you try and launch this news organization?
Well, I think it's an exciting time to start something new. You know, there's a lot of change in the air, some of which you see Bezos making changes at Washington Post or the big cable stations and what they're doing with their staffing levels. And then there's whole new things like Substack, right? So there's a lot of people who left legacy outfits and really went into business for themselves. And some have been quite successful at that, right? You can subscribe to a writer on Substack for a small amount of money. And if you get 100,000 people paying a small amount of money, it can really add up for some of these folks. So there are independent journalists out there. There's definitely space for startups like we have. And there's a big appetite there in Hawaii for new, right? We've been using the tagline, the new news for Hawaii. And we're hoping that people read us to get exactly that. What we'd like to offer people is our curiosity about the beats that we cover, our access to the people that we're able to reach. Maybe the idea that we would be asking different questions of the sources than other outlets might ask. Because, you know, one thing that goes on, too, as media shrinks is that their teams get smaller. They can't be everywhere. They can't look at everything. So we've had a couple of things just in our first early weeks here that I haven't really seen a lot of coverage on around town. Kaloa Rum just filed a lawsuit against the federal government over the Jones Act, right? Now, that's something Hawaii's been talking about for decades. And here we have a local business on Kauai that's actually doing something about it.
Right, that's not fair.
And so that was really interesting. That caught our eye. There was a protest over that House Bill H1118 about the religious exemption to vaccines. And I don't know that other people really covered the fact that there had been a protest or, you know, what people were concerned about. So things like that, right, where we can be everywhere. You know, one of the fun things about our location is when there is a protest downstairs at the Capitol, you know, if we've got time and somebody free, we'll just go downstairs, no matter what that thing is, that protest, and just ask people, hey, what's on your mind? What brought you out today? So we had an article about the Onipa'a Peace March, spent some time downstairs then, and same with the protest about the vaccine exemption.
Any final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, we really we aim to be very neighborhood oriented. So that's something I'm especially excited about. So one of the ways that we do that is the dining coverage and the sports coverage in particular. You know, we don't have any professional teams in Hawaii. So when you're talking about sports, you're talking about the high school in your hometown. You're talking about the university sports. We will also be getting into more history of Hawaii, which is something that everybody, we love our history here. Right. So our sports reporter had a piece about how Kahuku Red Raiders got their name. We'll be doing more of those, right? How all the different high school teams got their names, because there's great stories there.
That was A. Cam Napier, the editor-in-chief of the new online publication called Aloha State Daily. You can read the stories he mentioned at alohastatedaily.com.
Support for HPR comes from the East-West Center's Pacific Islands Report, featuring news headlines, essays, and commentary from across the Pacific Islands at pireport.org. Messaging supported by the Turbin Chu Fund.
HPR's Live from the Atherton presents Dr. John Osorio for a sold-out author event entitled Intimacies, Poetics of a People Beloved, where he discusses the significance of mele to our lives and the continuity of our people. For more information about this and future events, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Divers Jewelry, featuring tropical pearls, Hawaiian black coral, and gemstones in Made in Hawaii creations at locations across the islands and online at mauidivers.com.
An evolutionary war is playing out in many of our backyards, and it offers insights into how invasive species behave. A small parasitic fly listens to the mating call of the Pacific field cricket to track the insects down. And as these crickets have evolved different songs to escape the fly, it seems the fly has been able to adapt in a game of cat and mouse. Robin Ticatella is a behavioral ecologist at the University of Denver who studies the strange ways that these two creatures interact in Hawaii. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about her group's new research.
I study this interaction between a parasitic fly that is what we call an eavesdropper. So it's an animal that listens in on the conversations of other animals and uses the signals that they are using to communicate with each other in order to find a host or a prey item, essentially. So this parasitic fly is from North America and was introduced to the Hawaiian Islands probably about 35 years ago. And there, it had to essentially switch to a new host. So what this fly does is listen in on the songs that male field crickets are producing to attract female field crickets to them. So in Hawaii, there were none of the normal hosts that this fly would use in North America where they are native. But there is this field cricket called the Pacific field cricket that was actually also introduced to the Hawaiian Islands, but from the opposite side of the world. The cricket is native to northern and eastern coastal regions within Australia, and it island hopped through the Pacific, arriving most recently in Hawaii sometime between 700 and 1600 years ago. And so these two started to interact about 35 years ago when the parasitic fly arrived there. And the fly was able somehow to switch to this new host, this Pacific field cricket that it had never encountered before when it arrived in the Hawaiian Islands.
And for me, the research that your lab does is about like the pace of evolution in some ways, because you think of it as this long incremental process, but you found over the course of a few decades, the Pacific field crickets have started to switch their songs, or the ones that produce a slightly different song maybe have been selected for because they're not as targeted by the flies. And then in an evolutionary arms race, the flies seem to have caught up to them.
That's right. So about 20 years ago now, when I was a graduate student, we first found that Pacific field crickets had a mutation that changes their wing structures that they use to produce songs. And that first mutation actually caused them to go completely silent. So Hawaii has very special field crickets. Some of them are totally silent, and they stayed that way for about 15 years. And about 5 to 7 years ago now, we started to hear songs that didn't sound the way that we thought they should. So those were songs that I initially thought one of them was actually a purring cat that was in my room with me, but it turned out that cat was purring inside of my box of crickets, and that's how we discovered a first song that we called Purring. And then we started to hear things in our data sets after that that we couldn't explain also, and we called that song Rattling. So there are multiple different cricket songs, Pacific field cricket songs, that are evolving just over the last 5 to 7 years. And they're very cool because they are attenuated, so they're sort of quieter than the typical cricket song that these males would produce. And they also are really broadband, so they sound kind of scratchy instead of having that very pure tone, sort of classic crickety sound. And that combination of things makes them much harder for these flies to locate. So what it looked like for quite some time was that the crickets were sort of outpacing the flies' ability to evolve, right? Like the crickets were evolving these songs that allowed them to sort of go undetected by flies, but to still communicate with female crickets so they could attract females, but not simultaneously attract this deadly parasitic fly that was literally going to eat them from the inside out. So that was very cool. But then we started to see in the field that when we set up song traps, sound traps for these flies, every once in a while, a fly would be able to locate one of these novel songs, so a purring song or a rattling song. And that made us start to ask questions about whether the flies were going to be able to keep up in an evolutionary sense. So were we going to see rapid evolution of their ability to detect these songs evolve on that same pace that the crickets seem to be evolving new sounds?
I think that's a good place to get into this most recent study. share with us kind of the main takeaways from this study.
I think the overarching message is that the fly's hearing and behavior are pretty darn evolutionarily labile. So in Hawaii, they have actually evolved to be able to better detect this new host, the Pacific field cricket. And really remarkably, to us at least, their hearing and their behavioral responses suggest that they are even evolving the ability to better detect and to locate male crickets that sing these novel songs that evolved just a handful of years ago. And everything in the paper, both our field studies and our lab studies, point in that same direction.
Personally, I think this is fascinating research in and of itself, but let's also take the 10,000 foot view and think about a place like Hawaii, where we have all these introduced, in some cases invasive, non-native species interacting with each other and with native species in ways that we haven't seen before, and what research like this shows about those interactions.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that question. I think, you know, Hawaii is thought of as a paradise for a lot of reasons, but for biologists, it's sort of this magical paradise study system where we can watch evolution unfold before our eyes. And lots of really well-known examples of rapid evolution are set in Hawaii, including, for instance, these famous rapid adaptive radiations of things like Hawaiian Drosophila from a single common introduced ancestor to hundreds of then endemic species across the island chain. And there are reasons that that type of reaction happens on islands in particular, right? Almost everything you encounter was ultimately introduced at some point when it floated there or swam or flew or was blown in by the wind or dropped on the islands by traveling birds or people. So I think this set of characteristics has really led evolutionary biologists to think of the Hawaiian Islands as a sort of unique and ongoing series of evolutionary and ecological experiments. So when it comes to invasive species, one of the things that I don't think we often think about much is whether rapid evolution might be a mechanism that either contributes to their success or their failure. And that's because invaders might be able to evolve rapidly when they find themselves in new environments, and organisms that encounter a new invader might be able to avoid or evolve to avoid negative impacts of those interactions. So I think the 10,000 foot view on this is that understanding how evolution proceeds in these situations might be really critical to predicting how the ecological interactions between invasive and native organisms might play out longer term.
And then there's the part of it, too, that experiments like these, and even the natural experiments of seeing rapid evolution, tell you something about how other organisms can sense and perceive the world. Without those flies evolving to listen to a new cricket song, we maybe wouldn't have known that they can do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. The system is so interesting to sort of describe to people who have never heard of something like this, right? Because it's very intuitive, but it's also something that even if you've lived in Hawaii for a really long time and are very aware of your surroundings, you wouldn't have encountered, because you never run into these flies unless you happen to be walking around with a cricket song playing out of a speaker, right? It's not something that you're going to encounter randomly. It's a really special sort of thing to be able to dig in and study and to watch it longitudinally and see really how do these things play out over time.
What questions are you still interested in answering that you feel like are unsolved?
We have watched over the last 5 to 7 years at least 5 different new types of Pacific field cricket evolve that each sing a brand new song that has different characteristics and seem to be sticking around. Some of them are out competing each other. There are multiple different new types in some individual fields that are all competing with one another. And so I think one of our big questions is, why is this all happening now? If this fly was introduced about 35 years ago and, you know, first drove the evolution of silent crickets, why wasn't that good enough? Why wasn't it okay to just be silent? And we think we know the answer to that. It's really hard to attract mates if you're silent. But why now? What is it about, you know, these places or the circumstances or the weirdness of this system in general that makes it well suited to evolution sort of throwing a bunch of spaghetti at the wall at one time and asking what sticks. So I think we're really interested in understanding what facilitates all of these new songs evolving now. And we're tracking what happens. About every 6 months, we come out to Hawaii and do these long-term studies where we track the evolution of the crickets and the evolution of the flies now and look at their interactions and try and understand what is it that seems to be driving changes in the other. Are we really going to get a co-evolution story here? Or are we going to end up with these songs, you know, evolving in a direction that isn't conducive to the fly tracking that? So we're really interested in just getting the opportunity to continue watching this play out in real time.
That was University of Denver ecologist Robin Tintella and HPR's Maddie Bender. Tintella's group's new research into Pacific field crickets and parasitic flies was published in the journal Current Biology. We'll have a link to it on our website after the show.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
A film festival kicks off Friday at the Honolulu Museum of Art when Berlin and Beyond bid Aloha film Freude took its place. We talked to Dennis Saleh, who rallied with the festival's inaugural event last year. We also hear from Hawaii filmmaker Kiara Lacey about the cultural lens through which films are made and what we can learn from each other's point of view. Saleh starts us off.
Berlin Beyond was sponsored by the Goethe Institute, the cultural institute of the government of Germany. And at that point, I very quickly decided to bring on a new film festival. And we went on a deep dive into how would we call it, came up with the name Filmfreude. And Filmfreude was a construct because we were thinking of terms that Americans know that are actually German, such as Mensch or Angst or Fahrvergnügen or Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude, of course, we considered as our initial theme for our short film festival, but out of that came Filmfreude. And we made a couple of decisions. For one, we wanted to bring, you know, the contrary perspective on models of life, let's say. Secondly, we decided we're probably going to stay away from World War II for a while because all of us are oversaturated and there is another war going on. So it's very likely if you do a German film festival that at some point or another you'll come up with World War II, but we try not to. Not that we're opposed to it in any way. So we needed to basically start from scratch, create a company, a nonprofit, figure out how to make contact with film distributors. We were completely green on that. And here we are, second edition in March 14th.
And so do we have a focus this year, a theme?
Well, we have harmony, maybe. There's two films that focus on artists and their personal struggles in conjunction with their creativity. And then we have two films focusing on families in extreme situations and how they cope with the situation that they find themselves in.
And so this notion of creating films with a certain cultural lens, how do you see the Germans take on this?
You know, I've lived here for 25 years, so I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of both cultures after all this time. But it is such a stark contrast to watch German films when you live in America that I think this is an offering of alternative models. And it makes it really interesting to look at foreign films, not just German, but also German films, as another way to take life on. And these four films really do a great job on that.
And Kiara, jump in here, you know, because as a filmmaker, how do you look at this point of view?
I think it's exciting to kind of help our community learn and think in different ways. And I'm always excited to be able to grow. And I think what the festival is doing, particularly this year, sort of expanding opportunity for the community is pretty exciting with their filmmaking competition. We put together a little micro film festival competition with a theme. And Dennis can say it better than me because my German is not very good.
The word is doppelgänger.
Okay, and that's kind of a dead ringer for somebody?
No, doppelgänger means a copy of yourself, like an alter ego or a second of you, somebody who mimics you. So it's a word that doesn't exist in English, I think. It's a shadow of yourself, but not a shadow. It's you.
Okay. And so, Kiara, how did you look at this project then, taking it on?
Well, I think it was an exciting sort of like call to action to send out to the community. We gave a very short blurb saying the theme was doppelgänger and make a 1 to 3 minute film using this as inspiration. And we got back a really like fun group of options. We don't want to give too much away because we'll be sharing them at the festival. But I think it was a really exciting opportunity to kind of help the community connect with the festival and also like explore some German terminology.
Well, it sounds very wacky, but a lot of fun.
It is fun. And it like 1 to 3 minutes, a microfilm. You know, we do have some great short film festivals and festivals at home. But I think this is sort of like a special little unique opportunity for budding filmmakers, established filmmakers to try something a little different. And we got some really fun things that came in. So it's been a good experiment.
You know, in some ways, when you think of it, if you can be brief and to the point and precise, sometimes that is, you know, more powerful than getting very long-winded, right? It's like poetry. It's like, how do you convey that feeling in the least amount of words? But boy, do you get it spot on.
Yeah, yeah. We are having people make German haiku.
There you go. I like that. German
haiku. That's a good way to put it. You know, in news, I think most pieces are between 1:30 and 2:30. It's actually a good amount of time to tell a story. And it seems like our filmmakers didn't have any difficulty managing that short amount of time.
Yeah, get to the point.
Yeah.
Just get right to it. Keep it simple, stupid, right? Just boom.
The reason we chose a topic is really because we wanted to see if we could create a bridge between the two cultures, Hawaii and Germany, and see if people spin up a different take on a film if they get this one-word topic to deal with. Obviously, they had all the other freedoms. They could do whatever they wanted. I was really expecting to see a lot of AI work come in, but we didn't. It's all conventional production.
Interesting. Yeah. Anything that struck you in particular, Kiara?
We had like some really creative works, some things with puppets, some animation. So I didn't expect such a variety, but it was very cool to get in.
Well, I can't wait to see them. I'm looking forward to this. But this whole perspective, Dennis, of maybe the German point of view and, you know, how the Germans might create a film, let's say, that would be different from, let's say, a film coming out of Korea.
I'm not too familiar with Korean film, but I think what you're getting at is, what is that cultural mask that directors and filmmakers and actors have that makes it so different? I find one striking element of German film is how gentle people are, how they are accepting that somebody might be different on the other side, and they try to incorporate that and move on with it. That's very different from what I see in American-made movies, and I like it. It has a certain gentle flow to it that I find extremely pleasant.
Give an example.
One of the films is called When It Will Be Again Like It Never Was Before. It's about a family in a mental facility that the father runs and the family lives in. and the main character in the film falls in love with one of the patients. And, you know, they don't see the mentally ill people as mentally ill people. They see them as their extended family, which is a really unusual take on what happens inside a hospital, right? But the whole construct of this film is so different, and they really showcase a lot of humility and empathy, which I think is a great quality to showcase. And besides that, it's a greatly told story with a real bang, I think, that leaves you fulfilled.
And then, okay, what do you think? I mean, what strikes you when you look at German films?
I love sometimes the intensity and, like, just a different worldview. I think there is a lot of intentionality. I was actually just in Berlin at the film festival there, but I didn't even get a chance. It was so busy, I didn't get a chance to see enough films. So I think that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to be able to see more at home. I also feel like different eras have different things that speak to them. So I'm interested to see what this year's sort of group of films speak to.
I think another big topic in German film today is interculturality. We have, of course, a much different influx of people in Central Europe. You know, they're coming from all directions, from the east, from the west, the north, and the south. And they kind of meet in Germany. And I think German cinema has begun to incorporate that into their storytelling, what that means if people from Iran, people from Ukraine, or from Russia live and work in Germany. And you see a lot more of that. I think two of our films kind of deal with that on the sidelines, although they are historic pieces, period pieces. It still is part of the story that these cultures come together.
So film for thought.
Yeah.
So what are the particulars? What should our listeners know?
In terms of the films, we have film dealing with Kafka in the late part of his life, where he finds his probably one and only love. We have a film about Kandinsky, the Russian artist that formed the Blue Rider Group, and his underappreciated wife. We have a film that I mentioned earlier about the family living in a mental home. And then we have a lighter movie, that's our opening night film, called Everything's 50-50, where two high-achieving A-type helicopter parents deal with their divorce and the child in the middle. It's a comedy and really enjoyful a film. The whole festival starts on the 14th at HOMA in the Doris Duke Theater and ends on the 16th.
Come on out. We've got a really fun opening night event. I don't know if you want to share a little bit more about that, Dennis.
Oh, yeah. The opening night, we'll have a wonderful musician there by the name of Love Jack. And we'll have some lovely gelato from a German company here in Hawaii called Il Gelato.
Very good.
We'll have some other nice treats and hopefully really nice little party around that.
We have been hearing from Dennis Alle and Kiara Lacey about the upcoming German Film Festival at the Honolulu Museum of Art this weekend. Look for links on our website later today.
Dann denk ich mal was anderes als immer nur an dich. Denn das viele an dich denken bekommt mir nicht. Am nächsten Tag bin ich so.
Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the inaugural presidential chair of the East-West Center about the latest developments in South Korea. Share your comments or questions about what you've heard on our air by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.